2. Earth's lungs aren't burning. 1. Earth's lungs. In 2019, Leonardo DiCaprio, Madonna, and soccer star Cristiano Ronaldo shared photographs of the green Amazon rainforest ablaze with smoke pouring out of it. On Instagram, DiCaprio wrote, "The lungs of the earth are in flames." Ronaldo tweeted to his 82 million followers, "The Amazon rainforest produces more than 20% of the world's oxygen." The New York Times explained, "The Amazon is often referred to as Earth's lungs because its vast forests release oxygen and store carbon dioxide, a heat-trapping gas that is a major cause of global warming. The Amazon, which covers more than 2 million square miles of Brazil, Colombia, Peru, and other South American countries, could soon self-destruct," the Times reported. "It would be a nightmare scenario that could see much of the world's largest rainforest erased from the earth. Some scientists who study the Amazon ecosystem call it imminent," wrote another Times reporter. "If enough Amazon rainforest is lost and can't be restored, the area will become savanna, which doesn't store as much carbon, meaning a reduction in the planet's lung capacity." Writers compared the Amazon fires to the detonation of nuclear weapons. "The destruction of the Amazon is arguably far more dangerous than the weapons of mass destruction that have triggered a robust response," wrote a reporter for The Atlantic. "If another 20% of the Amazon is lost," wrote a reporter for The Intercept, "it would release a doomsday bomb of stored carbon." The news media, high-profile celebrities, and European leaders blamed Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro. European leaders threatened not to ratify a major trade deal with Brazil. "Our house is burning, literally," tweeted French President Emmanuel Macron, days before he hosted a meeting of the 7 largest economies, the G7, in France. Beyond the Amazon, reported the Times, in Central Africa, vast stretches of savanna are going up in flame. Arctic regions in Siberia are burning at a historic pace. 1 month later, Greta Thunberg and other student climate activists sued Brazil for not doing enough to stop climate change. "Brazil's rollbacks are already starting to have a damaging effect," the students' attorneys wrote. "As it stands, the Amazon acts as a large carbon sink, absorbing a quarter of the carbon taken up by forests around the world every year. Like many Generation Xers, my concern about rainforest destruction dates back to the late 1980s. In 1987, a San Francisco environmental group called Rainforest Action Network launched a consumer boycott against the fast food giant Burger King, which was purchasing hamburger meat produced on land in Costa Rica that was formerly a rainforest. In order to produce beef, farmers in Latin America and other countries clear rainforests in order to raise and graze cattle. I watched CNN and other TV news outlets show dramatic images of fires and indigenous people fleeing their ancestral homes. Upset by the images of destruction, I held a backyard party on my 16th birthday to raise money for Rainforest Action Network. I charged people $5 to attend and raised about $100. Today, as back then, the use of land as pasture for beef production is humankind's single largest use of Earth's surface. We use twice as much land for beef and dairy production as for our second largest use of Earth, which is growing crops. Nearly half of Earth's total agricultural land area is required for ruminant livestock, which includes cows, sheep, goats, and buffalo. In the Amazon, the first people to exploit the forest are loggers, who extract valuable wood. They are followed by ranchers who cut down the forest, burn it, and then graze cattle to establish ownership. Because beef production was causing rainforest destruction, I stopped eating it and became fully vegetarian when I went to college in fall 1989. For me, the nightmare of rainforest destruction was balanced by a feeling of success. By October 1987, Rainforest Action Network's Burger King boycott had succeeded. The fast food chain announced it would stop importing beef from Costa Rica. In some small way, I felt I had helped save the rainforests. 2. There's no science behind that. At 15 years old, I started an Amnesty International chapter at my high school. A teacher asked my club supervisor, the school counselor, whether I was a communist. 2 years later, I confirmed their suspicions by persuading my school principal to let me spend the fall semester of my senior year in Nicaragua to learn Spanish and witness the Sandinista socialist revolution. Afterward, I traveled throughout Central America, making relationships with small farmer cooperatives. While attending college, I learned Portuguese, so I could live in Brazil and work with the Landless Workers Movement and the Workers' Party in the semi-Amazonian state of Maranhão in Brazil. I returned there several times between 1992 and 1995. I loved Brazil and even imagined for a time that I would move there permanently to work with the Landless Workers and Workers' Party. I attended the 1992 United Nations Environment Summit in Rio de Janeiro, where deforestation was a hot topic. The head of Rainforest Action Network, who 5 years earlier had forced Burger King to change its practices, staged a noisy protest. I was swept up in the excitement of a country emerging from several decades of military dictatorship. I returned to Brazil several more times. I did fieldwork in the semi-Amazon with small farmers defending their land from larger farmers seeking to take it over. I dated a Brazilian documentary filmmaker who was connected to the Workers' Party and left-wing non-governmental organization NGO scene in Rio de Janeiro. By 1995, I was interviewing the leading lights of Brazil's progressive movement, from the first Afro-Brazilian senator and favelada, Benedita da Silva, as well as Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who went on to be elected president in 2002. I continued to write about the Amazon throughout the years, and so, when the firestorm of publicity over the Amazon raged in the late summer of 2019, I decided to call Dan Nepstad, a lead author of a recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC report, on the Amazon. I asked him whether it was true that the Amazon was a major source of Earth's oxygen supply. "It's bullshit," he told me. "There's no science behind that. The Amazon produces a lot of oxygen, but it uses the same amount of oxygen through respiration, so it's a wash." According to an Oxford University ecologist who studies them, Amazon plants consume about 60% of the oxygen they produce in respiration, the biochemical process whereby they obtain energy. Microbes, which break down rainforest biomass, consume the other 40%. So, in all practical terms, the net contribution of the Amazon ecosystem, not just the plants alone, to the world's oxygen is effectively zero, the ecologist writes. The same is pretty much true of any ecosystem on Earth, at least on the time scales that are relevant to humans, less than millions of years. As for lungs, they absorb oxygen and emit carbon dioxide. By contrast, the Amazon and all plant life store carbon, though not 25%, as the student climate activists who sued Brazil claimed, but rather 5%. As for the photos that celebrities shared on social media, they weren't actually of the Amazon on fire. Many weren't even of the Amazon. The photo Ronaldo shared was taken in southern Brazil, far from the Amazon, and it was taken in 2013, not 2019. The photo Madonna shared was more than 30 years old. In reality, almost everything the news media reported in summer 2019 about the Amazon was either wrong or deeply misleading. Deforestation had risen, but the increase had started in 2013, a full 6 years before President Bolsonaro took office. In 2019, the area of Amazon land deforested was just one quarter of the amount of land that was deforested in 2004. And while the number of fires in Brazil in 2019 was indeed 50% higher than the year before, it was just 2% higher than the average during the previous 10 years. Against the horrifying picture painted of an Amazon forest on the verge of disappearing, a full 80% remain standing. Between 18 to 20% of the Amazon forest is still up for grabs, terra devoluta, and remains at risk of being deforested. It is true, however, that deforestation is fragmenting the Amazon and destroying the habitats of species of high conservation value. Big cats, such as jaguars, pumas, and ocelots, and other large mammal species, need contiguous, unfragmented habitat to survive and thrive. Many tropical species, including ones in the Amazon, depend on primary old-growth forest. While mammals can re-inhabit secondary forests, it often takes many decades or even centuries for forests to return to their original abundance. But rainforests in the Amazon and elsewhere in the world can only be saved if the need for economic development is accepted, respected, and embraced. By opposing many forms of economic development in the Amazon, particularly the most productive forms, many environmental NGOs, European governments, and philanthropies have made the situation worse. 3. Looking down on the poor. In 2016, the Brazilian model Gisele Bündchen flew over the Amazon forest with the head of Greenpeace Brazil as part of a National Geographic television series called Years of Living Dangerously. At first, they fly over an endless green forest. "The beauty seems to go on forever," Bündchen says in her voiceover. But then Greenpeace's Paulo Adario tells me to brace myself. She is horrified by what comes next. Below her are fragments of forest next to cattle ranches. "All these large geometric shapes carved into the landscape are because of cattle?" she asks. "Everything starts with small logging roads," Adario explains. "The road stays, and then a cattle rancher comes, and then he starts cutting the remaining trees." "And cattle is not even natural of the Amazon," Bündchen says. "It is not even supposed to be here." "No, definitely not," confirms Adario. "Imagine the destruction of this beautiful forest to produce cattle. When you eat a burger, you don't realize your burger is coming from rainforest destruction." Bündchen starts to tear up. "It's shocking, isn't it?" asks Adario. But is it really so shocking? After all, agricultural expansion in Brazil is happening nearly identically to how it occurred in Europe hundreds of years ago. Between 500 and 1350, forests went from covering 80% of Western and Central Europe to covering half of that. Historians estimate that the forests of France were reduced from being 30 million hectares, about 74 million acres, to 13 million, about 32 million acres, between 800 and 1300. Forests covered 70% of Germany in the year 900, but just 25% by 1900. And yet developed nations, particularly European ones, which grew wealthy thanks to deforestation and fossil fuels, are seeking to prevent Brazil and other tropical nations, including the Congo, from developing the same way. Most of them, including Germans, produce more carbon emissions per capita, including by burning biomass, than do Brazilians even when taking into account Amazon deforestation. The good news is that globally, forests are returning and fires are declining. There was a whopping 25% decrease in the annual area burned globally from 1998 to 2015, thanks mainly to economic growth. That growth created jobs in cities for people, allowing them to move away from slash-and-burn farming. And economic growth allowed farmers to clear forests for agriculture using machines instead of fire. Globally, new tree growth exceeded tree loss for the last 35 years by an area the size of Texas and Alaska combined. An area of forest the size of Belgium, Netherlands, Switzerland, and Denmark combined grew back in Europe between 1995 and 2015. And the amount of forests in Sweden, Greta Thunberg's home nation, has doubled during the last century. Roughly 40% of the planet has seen greening, more forest and other biomass growth, between 1981 and 2016. Some of this greening is due to a reversion of former agricultural lands to grasslands and forests, and some of it is due to deliberate tree planting, particularly in China. This is even true in Brazil. While the world's attention has been focused on the Amazon, forests are returning in the southeast, which is the more economically developed part of Brazil. This is due to both rising agricultural productivity and environmental conservation. Part of the reason the planet is greening stems from greater carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and greater planetary warming. Scientists find that plants grow faster as a result of higher carbon dioxide concentrations. From 1981 to 2016, 4 times more carbon was captured by plants due to carbon-boosted growth than from biomass covering a larger surface of Earth. There is little evidence that forests around the world are already at their optimum temperature and carbon levels. Scientists find that higher levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere available for photosynthesis will likely offset declines in the productivity of photosynthesis from higher temperatures. A major study of 55 temperate forests found higher growth than expected, due to higher temperatures resulting in a longer growing season, higher carbon dioxide, and other factors. And faster growth means there will be a slower accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. None of this is to suggest that rising carbon emissions and climate change bring no risks. They do. But we have to understand that not all of their impacts will be bad for the natural environment and human societies. Nor does any of this mean we shouldn't be concerned about the loss of primary old-growth forests in the Amazon and elsewhere in the world. We should be. Old-growth forests offer unique habitats to species. While the total amount of forest cover in Sweden has doubled during the last century, many of the new forests have been in the form of monocultural tree farms. But if we are to protect the world's remaining old-growth forests, we're going to need to reject environmental colonialism and support nations in their aspirations to develop. 4. Romance and Reality. I am sensitive to the insensitive behaviors of developed world environmentalists because I lived with the small farmers Bunchen looked down upon, and life was exceedingly difficult. I grew up in middle-class comfort and was unprepared for the extreme poverty I experienced when I went to Nicaragua as a teenager. In lieu of hot showers and flush toilets, I poured bowls of cold water over my head, shivered, and used outhouses like everyone else. Several times I became sick, likely from contaminated water. The country was in its 9th year of civil war, and people were increasingly desperate. One night, my Spanish teacher hosted her students for dinner. She lived in what can only be described as a shack, roughly 30 feet by 10 feet. I helped make spaghetti. We drank beer and smoked cigarettes. I asked her, tactlessly, how much it would cost to buy a house like hers. She responded by offering to sell it to me for $100. I came home with intestinal parasites and a burning desire to help improve lives there. Life in the Amazon was in many ways much harder than life in Central America because the communities are so much more remote. I lived in communities in Brazil that engaged in slash-and-burn agriculture. It starts with cutting trees in the forest letting the wood and biomass dry, then burning it. The ash fertilizes the fields. Crops are then planted, returning a very small yield. The people I worked with were too poor to have much livestock, though that was the next rung up the economic ladder. Slashing and burning was brutal work. The men drank large quantities of rum while doing it. We passed cooler and more pleasant afternoons fishing at the river. The Amazon and semi-Amazonian northwest and central regions of Brazil are as hot as the Congo, with annual average temperatures near 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Higher temperatures reduce labor productivity, which helps explain why nations in tropical climates are less developed than nations in temperate ones. It is simply too hot to work for much of the day. In Brazil, as in Nicaragua, my enthusiasm for socialist cooperatives was often greater than that of the small farmers who were supposed to benefit from them. Most of the small farmers I interviewed wanted to work their own plot of land. They might be great friends with their neighbors and even be related to them by birth or marriage, but they didn't want to farm with them. They didn't want to be taken advantage of by somebody who didn't work as hard as them, they told me. I can count on a single hand the number of young people who told me they wanted to remain on their family's farm and work their parents' land. The large majority of young people wanted to go to the city, get an education, and get a job. They wanted a better life than what low-yield peasant farming could provide. They wanted a life more like mine. And I knew, of course, that I didn't want to be a small farmer. Why did I ever think anyone else wanted to? The reality I lived, up close and in person, made it impossible for me to hold on to my romantic views. In August 2019, the news media's portrayal of the burning rainforest as a result of greedy corporations, nature-hating farmers, and corrupt politicians annoyed me. I had understood for a quarter century that rising deforestation and fires are primarily the result of politicians responding to popular economic demands, not lack of concern for the natural environment. The reason deforestation in Brazil rose again starting in 2013 was that of a severe economic recession and reduced law enforcement. The election of Bolsonaro in 2018 was as much an effect of rising demand for land as it was a cause of rising deforestation. Of Brazil's 210 million people, a full 55 million live in poverty. An additional 2 million Brazilians fell into poverty between 2016 and 2017. And the notion that the Amazon is populated mostly by indigenous people victimized by non-indigenous is wrong. Just 1 million of the 30 million Brazilians who live in the Amazon region are indigenous, and some tribes control very large reserves. There are 690 indigenous reserves covering an astonishing 13% of Brazil's landmass, almost all of them in the Amazon. Just 19,000 Yanomami Indians effectively own an area slightly larger than the size of Hungary. Some engage in logging. Anyone looking to understand why Brazil cuts down its rainforests to produce soy and meat for export must start with the reality that it is trying to lift the last one quarter of its population out of a poverty comparable to that of Bernadette in the Congo, of which environmentalists in Europe and North America are oblivious or worse, unconcerned. 5. Fire and food. Sometime between AD 900 and 950, Maori hunter-gatherers arrived by boat at what is today known as New Zealand, likely from other Pacific islands to the northeast. To their delight, they found the island thick with moas, ostrich-like birds that stood an astonishing 16 feet tall. Moas weren't able to fly, nor did they have any other means to protect themselves from the Maori. To catch them, the Maori would set forest fires, which would push moas to the edges of the forest where they could be more easily slaughtered. The Maori came to rely so much on moas for food, as well as tools and jewelry, that they called them their primary source. During dry and windy seasons, the fires burned large landscapes, massively altered natural environments, and destroyed the habitats of other species. In New Zealand, the conifer forests burned quickly during the hot and dry summer months and could not regenerate. They were replaced by bracken, fern, and scrub. But this hadn't put an end to the Maori practice of starting forest fires. "We saw either smoke by day and fires by night," Captain Cook wrote, "in all parts of it." Within 300 years, half of New Zealand was deforested. Moas teetered on the brink of extinction, and the Maori were facing rapid environmental and social change. By the time Cook arrived in the 1770s, the Maori had completely wiped out the moa, and they had been forced to take up slash and burn farming. What happened in New Zealand was typical of what had happened around the world 10,000 years ago. A few million humans globally killed millions of large mammals each year, resulting in species extinctions. What we today view as a pleasing natural landscape, a grassy meadow surrounded by a forest and with a river running through it, is often a landscape created by humans to hunt game, seeking out drinking water. Using fire to create a meadow in which to slaughter animals is one of the most frequent mentions of the uses of fire by hunter-gatherers around the world. The meadows of the North American eastern forests would have disappeared had they not been burned annually by Indians for 5,000 years. And in the Amazon, hunter-gatherers burned forests and introduced new species. Hunting by luring game is more energy efficient than chasing it. Over time, trapping wild animals within enclosed spaces evolved into the domestication of animals for livestock. Fire made communities more secure from human and non-human predators, allowed them to expand all over the world, and required new behaviors around eating, organizing societies, and procreating. Hunting with fire became a crucial milestone in the creation of both what we think of as nation-states and markets, through the demarcation of control by individuals and groups competing for food. Indeed, fire was used differently in different zones for security, agriculture, and hunting. Fire allowed for the creation of sexually monogamous family units, and it allowed for the hearth as a place for reflection and discussion and widening social and group intelligence. All over the planet, deforestation through fire gave rise to agriculture by fertilizing soils, favoring blueberries, hazelnuts, grains, and other useful crops. Today, many tree species require fire for their seeds to grow into trees. Fire is also essential, as we saw with both California and Australia, for clearing woody biomass from the forest floor. In short, fire and deforestation for meat production is a major part of what made us humans. The only way Addario, Bunchen, and other environmentalists could find meat production in the Amazon so shocking is by knowing none of that history. For 21st century environmentalists, the word wilderness has positive connotations, but in the past it was a frightful place of wild beasts. European farmers viewed forests as places of danger, which they often were, home to both dangerous animals like wolves and menacing humans like outlaw gangs. In the fairy tale Hansel and Gretel, two children get lost in the forest and fall into the hands of a witch. In Little Red Riding Hood, a little girl traveling through the forest is terrorized by a wolf. Thus, for early European Christians, removing the forest was good, not bad. Early Christian fathers, including St. Augustine, taught that it was humankind's role to finalize God's creation on earth and grow closer to Him. Forests and wilderness areas were places of sin. Clearing them to make farms and ranches was the Lord's work. Europeans believed humans were blessed and distinct for their transformative powers. Monks tasked with the work of creating a clearing in the woods literally imagined themselves expelling the devil from earth. They weren't trying to create Eden, but rather a new Jerusalem, a civilization that mixed town and country, sacred and profane, commerce and faith. It was only after humans started living in cities and growing wealthier that they started to worry about nature for nature's sake. Europeans who in the 19th century had viewed the Amazon as jungle, a place of danger and disorder, came to see it in the late 20th century as rainforest, a place of harmony and enchantment. 6. Greenpeace fragments the forest. Insensitivity to Brazil's need for economic development led environmental groups, including Greenpeace, to advocate policies that contributed to the fragmentation of the rainforest and the unnecessary expansion of cattle ranching and farming. Environmental policies should have resulted in intensification, growing more food on less land. Instead, they resulted in extensification and a political and grassroots backlash by farmers that resulted in rising deforestation. The mastermind of the soy moratorium was Paulo Adario of Greenpeace Brazil, said Nepstad. Adario is the man who made Bunchen cry. It started with a Greenpeace campaign. People dressed up like chickens and walked through a number of McDonald's restaurants in Europe. It was a big international media moment. Greenpeace demanded a far stricter forest code than the one that had been imposed by the Brazilian government. Greenpeace and other environmental NGOs insisted that landowners keep a large amount, 50 to 80% of their property, as forest through Brazil's forest code. Nepstad said the stricter forest code cost farmers $10 billion in foregone profits and forest restoration. There was an Amazon fund set up in 2010 with $1 billion from Norwegian and German governments, but none of it ever made its way to the large and medium-sized farmers, said Nepstad. Agribusiness is 25% of Brazil's GDP, and it's what got the country through the recession, said Nepstad. When soy farming comes into a landscape, the number of fires goes down. Little towns get money for schools, GDP rises, and inequality declines. This is not a sector to beat up on. It's one to find common ground with. Greenpeace sought stricter restrictions on farming in the savanna forest, known as the Cerrado, where much of the soy in Brazil is grown. Farmers got nervous that there was going to be another moratorium by governments on Brazilian soy imports, explains Nepstad. The Cerrado is 60% of the nation's soy crop. The Amazon is 10%, and so this was a much more serious matter. Greenpeace's campaign led journalists, policymakers, and the public to conflate the Cerrado savanna with the Amazon rainforest, and thus believe that the expansion of soy farming in the Cerrado was the same as logging the rainforest. But there is far more economic and ecological justification for deforestation in the Cerrado, which is less biologically diverse and has soils more suited to soy farming than in the rainforest. By conflating the two regions, Greenpeace and journalists exaggerated the problem and created the wrong impression that both places are of equal ecological and economic value. Greenpeace wasn't the first organization that has tried to prevent Brazil from modernizing and intensifying agriculture. In 2008, the World Bank published a report that basically said that small is beautiful, that modern, technologically sophisticated agriculture, and especially the use of GMOs, was bad, wrote the World Bank's representative at the time to Brazil. The report said that the path that should be followed was small and organic and local agriculture. The World Bank report enraged Brazil's agriculture minister, who called the bank's representative and asked, "How can the World Bank produce such an absurd report? Following the wrong path, Brazil has become an agricultural superpower, producing three times the output we produced 30 years ago, with 90% of this coming from productivity gains." The report added insult to injury. The World Bank had already cut 90% of its development aid for Brazil's agricultural research efforts as punishment because Brazil sought to grow food in the same ways that wealthy nations do. Brazil was able to make up for the aid that World Bank had denied it with its own resources. After it did so, Greenpeace pressured food companies in Europe to stop buying soy from Brazil. "There's this exaggerated confidence, this hubris," said Nepstad, "that regulation upon regulation, without really thinking of the farmer's perspective." "Much of the motivation to stop farming and ranching is ideological," Nepstad said. "It's really anti-development, you know, anti-capitalism. There's a lot of hatred of agribusiness, or at least hatred of agribusiness in Brazil. The same standard doesn't seem to apply to agribusiness in France and Germany." The increase in deforestation in 2019 is to some extent Bolsonaro fulfilling a campaign promise to farmers who were fatigued with violence, the recession, and this environmental agenda, Nepstad said. They were all saying, you know, it's this forest agenda that will get this guy, Bolsonaro, elected. We're all going to vote for him. And farmers voted for him in droves. I see what's happening now, and the election of Bolsonaro, as a reflection of major mistakes in environmentalist strategy. I asked Nepstad how much of the backlash was due to the government's enforcement of environmental laws and how much was due to NGOs like Greenpeace. "I think most of it was NGO dogmatism," he said. "We were in a really interesting space in 2012, 2013, 2014, because the farmers felt satisfied with the article of the Forest Code dedicated to compensating farmers, but it never happened. Brazil's soy farmers were willing to cooperate with reasonable environmental rules before Greenpeace started making more extreme demands. What the farmers needed was basically amnesty on all of the illegal deforestation up through 2008, said Nepstad. And winning that, they felt like, okay, we could comply with this law. I side with the farmers on this. What's happened in the Amazon is a reminder that concentrating farming in some areas allows governments to protect primary forest habitats so that they can remain relatively intact, wild, and biodiverse. The Greenpeace/NGO strategy resulted in landowners clearing forest elsewhere in order to expand their footprint. "I think the Forest Code has fostered fragmentation," Nepstad told me. Green NGOs have had a similar impact in other parts of the world. After environmentalists encouraged such fragmentation in palm oil plantations in Southeast Asia, as a measure supposedly friendly to wildlife, scientists found a 60% reduction in the abundance of important bird species. 7. Take your dough and reforest Germany. Greenpeace's agenda fit neatly into the agenda of European farmers to exclude low-cost Brazilian food from the European Union. The two European nations that were the most critical of deforestation and fires in the Amazon also happened to be the two countries whose farmers most resisted the Mercosur Free Trade Agreement with Brazil, France, and Ireland. "Brazilian farmers want to extend the free trade agreement, EU-Mercosur," noted Nepstad. "But French President Emmanuel Macron is inclined to shut it down because the French farm sector doesn't want more Brazilian food products coming into the country." Indeed, it was President Macron who started the global news media fervor about Amazon deforestation just a few days before France hosted the G7 meeting. Macron said France would not ratify a major trade deal between Europe and Brazil so long as Brazil's president did nothing to reduce deforestation. In Brussels, the capital of the European Commission, the attacks on Brazil by France and Ireland raised eyebrows, noted Forbes business reporter Dave Keating. These also happen to be the two countries who have been most vocally opposed to the Mercosur deal on protectionist grounds. According to Keating, They are worried that their farmers will be overwhelmed by competition from South American beef, sugar, ethanol, and chicken. Beef, a staple of Argentinian and Brazilian agricultural exports, has been the most sensitive issue in these trade negotiations. Irish farmers in particular are expected to have a tough time competing with the influx. I don't doubt the sincerity of Macron's wish to protect the Paris Agreement, a EU trade expert told Keating, but it strikes me as suspicious that it's these two countries raising the objection. It makes you wonder whether the Amazon fires are being used as a smokescreen for protectionism. Macron's attacks enraged Brazil's president. Few countries have the moral authority to talk about deforestation with Brazil, said President Bolsonaro. I would like to give a message to the beloved German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Take your dough and reforest Germany, okay? It's much more needed there than here. There was nothing right-wing about the anger of Brazil's president with foreign hypocrisy. Brazil's former socialist president grew just as angry at the hypocrisy and neo-imperialism of foreign governments more than a decade earlier. The wealthy countries are very smart, approving protocols, holding big speeches on the need to avoid deforestation, said President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in 2007, but they already deforested everything. 8. After Amazon alarmism. The increase in Amazon deforestation should lead the conservation community to repair its relationship with farmers and seek more pragmatic solutions. Farmers should be allowed to intensify production in some areas, particularly the Cerrado, to reduce pressure and fragmentation in other areas, particularly the rainforest. Creating parks and protected areas goes hand in hand with agricultural intensification, simply making farming and ranching more productive and profitable without protecting natural areas is insufficient. By protecting some areas and intensifying on already existing farms and ranches, Brazilian farmers and ranches could grow more food on less land and protect the natural environment. Researchers have found that the production of beef in Brazil is at less than half of its potential, which means that the amount of land required to produce beef could be massively reduced. Brazil's lesser-known Atlantic forest, far more of which has been lost than the Amazon, could benefit enormously. There is enough land for a large-scale restoration of the Atlantic forest, the hottest of hotspots, wrote a group of scientists, where up to 18 million hectares, an area twice the size of Portugal, could be restored without impeding national agricultural expansion. This would more than double the remaining area of this biome, slow the massive species extinctions, and sequester 7.5 billion tons of CO2. Nepstad agrees. There's a huge area of unproductive land that's growing 50 kilos of beef per hectare a year that should all go back to the forest. In the Cerrado, the daily weight gain in milk production can be 3 times higher after simply switching to faster-growing and more nutritious grasses and using fertilizer. Doing so brings the added benefit of cutting methane emissions, a greenhouse gas, per kilogram of meat, in half, while reducing the amount of land required. Let's get the agrarian reform reserves, which are huge and close to cities, to grow vegetables and fruits and staples for the Amazon cities instead of them importing tomatoes and carrots from Sao Paulo, said Nepstad. The World Bank and other agencies should support farmers seeking to intensify agricultural production. Research suggests that Brazilian farmers receiving technical assistance was the key factor in their adoption of methods proven to increase productivity. The determination by activist journalists and TV producers to paint deforestation in the Amazon as apocalyptic was inaccurate and unfair. Worse, it further polarized the situation in Brazil, making it harder to find pragmatic solutions between farmers and conservationists. As for the myth that the Amazon provides 20% of the world's oxygen, It appears to have evolved out of a 1966 article by a Cornell University scientist. 4 years later, a climatologist explained in the journal Science why there was nothing to be frightened of. In almost all grocery lists of man's environmental problems is found an item regarding oxygen supply. Fortunately for mankind, the supply is not vanishing as some have predicted. Unfortunately, neither is the supply of environmental alarmism.